Disc 21.
Hamilton tackled the task with exemplary energy, giving depth and scope and sterling expression to the overarching themes listed by Washington. That summer, he prepared two documents for Washington. One was a reworking of the Madison-Washington draft, and the other his own version of the speech. Washington preferred the latter, which became the basis of the final product. But the president was bothered by the length of Hamilton's draft. He had envisioned something elegant and concise, which could fit into a newspaper. All the columns of a large gazette would scarcely, I conceive, contain the present draft, he told Hamilton. By now a seasoned ghostwriter, Hamilton speedily pruned his draft to a more compact size. Washington and Hamilton honed and polished the speech until it had a uniformly authoritative voice. Occasionally, Hamiltonian thunder rumbled through the prose, as in the ranting line that factions can become potent engines by which cunning, ambitious, and unprincipled men will be enabled to subvert the power of the people and to usurp for themselves the reins of government. In general, however, their two voices blended admirably together. The result was a literary miracle. If Hamilton was the major wordsmith, Washington was the tutelary spirit and final arbiter of what went in. The poignant opening section in which Washington thanked the American people could never have been written by Hamilton alone. Conversely, the soaring central section, with its sophisticated perspective on policy matters, showed Hamilton's unmistakable stamp. It is difficult to disentangle the contributions of Washington and Hamilton because their ideas overlapped on many issues. Both men were still smarting over the Jay Treaty dispute and livid at reports that France might send an envoy and a fleet to demand its immediate repeal. Were it not for domestic acrimony over the treaty, Washington told Hamilton, he would tell the French bluntly, "We are an independent nation and act for ourselves. Having fulfilled our engagements with other nations and having decided on and strictly observed a neutral conduct towards the belligerent powers, we will not be dictated to by the politics of any nation under heaven farther than treaties require of us." The farewell address sprang from this recent experience. As its centerpiece, the farewell address called for American neutrality, shorn of names and party labels. Hamilton's words, however, were saturated with arguments that he had used to promote the Jay Treaty. Beneath its impartial air, the farewell address took dead aim at the Jeffersonian romance with France. When Hamilton implied that it was folly for one nation to expect disinterested favors from another, he restated an old argument against Jefferson, that France had aided America during the Revolution only to harm England. When Hamilton sounded the great theme that the United States should steer clear of permanent foreign alliances, that nation which indulges towards another a habitual hatred or a habitual fondness is in some degree a slave, he echoed his earlier statements about Republicans betraying a reflexive hatred of England and adoration of France. Even his comments on the need for religion and morality, slightly altered in the final version, arose from his horror at the atheistic French Revolution. Religion and morality are essential props. In vain does that man claim the praise of patriotism who labors to subvert or undermine these great pillars of human happiness. The domestic portion of the address was a digest of ideas that Hamilton had advanced under Washington's aegis. Hamilton expressed an urgent plea for preserving the Union and enumerated various threats. He cited the danger of domestic factions, which could become vehicles for unscrupulous men, urged a vigorous central government to protect liberty, stressed public credit and the need to control deficits, and invoked the sacred duty of obeying the Constitution. In a country riven by quarrels, Hamilton produced a harmonious vision of complementary parts. Agriculture and commerce were mutually beneficial. North and South, the western frontier and the eastern seaboard, enjoyed complementary economies. The only thing needed to capitalize on these strengths was national unity. The farewell address was meant to be printed, not spoken, and Washington consulted Hamilton about the optimal time and place for publication. On September 19, 1796, it appeared in Claypool's American Daily Advertiser and was then reprinted in newspapers across the country. It can be read two ways: as a dispassionate statement of American principles and as a thinly disguised attack on the Republicans. With consummate artistry, Washington and Hamilton had extracted general themes from particular debates about the Jay Treaty, the Whiskey Rebellion, and other events, and endowed them with universal meaning. Over time, the underlying events have faded away, lending the aphorisms an oracular quality. The arguments for neutrality and a foreign policy based on national interests became especially influential. It was the first statement, comprehensive and authoritative at the same time, of the principles of American foreign policy, Felix Gilbert has written. A century later, as the document evolved into a canonical text, Congress read the speech aloud each year on Washington's birthday. Though contemporary Americans hailed the address, the Republican reaction was venomous and unwittingly underscored its urgent plea for unity. One newspaper denounced Washington's words as the loathings of a sick mind. In the Aurora, Benjamin Franklin Bache dredged up the old wives' tale that Washington had conspired with the British during the Revolution. Bache also gave prominent play to an open letter to Washington from Thomas Paine, the author of Common Sense, expressing the hope that Washington would die and telling him that the world will be puzzled to decide whether you are an apostate or an impostor, whether you have abandoned good principles or whether you ever had any. Though never humble, Hamilton could be self-effacing in serving Washington and his country. Only a handful of intimates, Eliza, Robert Troup, and John Jay among them, knew that he had crafted the president's address. Fired by a sense that Hamilton had been denied credit, Eliza often recollected the composition of the address. More than 40 years later, she testified that Hamilton had written it principally at such time as his office was seldom frequented by his clients and visitors, and during the absence of his students to avoid interruption, at which times he was in the habit of calling me to sit with him that he might read to me as he wrote, in order, as he said, to discover how it sounded upon the ear, and making the remark, "My dear Eliza, you must be to me what Molière's old nurse was to him." Molière was popularly reported to have tested dramatic speeches on his old nurse to get her reaction. The whole or nearly all of the address was read to me by him as he wrote it, and a greater part, if not all, was written by him in my presence. After the farewell address appeared, it was sold widely in pamphlet form. Eliza cherished the memory of strolling down Broadway with her husband when an old soldier accosted them and tried to sell them a copy. After buying one, Hamilton said laughingly to Eliza, "That man does not know he has asked me to purchase my own work." Hamilton's central role also stayed a well-kept secret because Washington's admirers feared its disclosure might detract from the ex-president's Olympian stature. They perhaps succeeded too well. After Hamilton's death, his draft of the farewell address and all related correspondence with Washington were entrusted to Rufus King. In the 1820s, Eliza and her sons had to file a lawsuit to retrieve the documents from King, who relinquished them only reluctantly. Later, Eliza recorded her memories of the events surrounding the farewell address so that my children should be fully acquainted with the services rendered by their father to our country and the assistance given by him to General Washington during his administration for the one great object, the independence and stability of the government of the United States. For all the strife surrounding his time in office, historians now routinely rank George Washington with Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt as one of the three outstanding American presidents. Washington left a legacy of prosperity, neutrality, sound public credit, stable government, and a viable constitution. As the resident policy genius of the administration, Hamilton deserves a large share of the accolades. Why, then, was he not a presidential candidate in 1796 or beyond? He had the advantage of being a major Federalist, perhaps the major Federalist, at a time when party elites chose presidential candidates. Nevertheless, Hamilton gave no hint that he or anybody else envisioned him as Washington's successor, and he never received a single electoral vote in a presidential contest. How to explain the paradox that a man of such unbounded talent and ambition never attained the top office or even made a covert run for it? Surely he must have wanted to be president. The conundrum can be solved partly by noting that the political stars were never suitably aligned for Hamilton. Obviously, he could not have challenged Washington for the presidency, and as John Adams correctly told Abigail, "I am the heir apparent." Hamilton himself had stated that Adams, Jefferson, and Jay, by virtue of their seniority, were seen as presumptive presidential contenders. Also, Hamilton left the government determined to repair his finances and refurbish his legal practice. Moreover, by then he was so controversial, so divisive, that the mere mention of his name could trigger debates. Adored by followers, he was seen as cocky, conceited, and swaggering by his enemies. Other reasons account for Hamilton's failure to snatch the prize. Though blessed with a great executive mind and a consummate policymaker, Hamilton could never master the smooth restraint of a mature politician. His conception of leadership was noble but limiting. The true statesman defied the wishes of the people, if necessary, and shook them from wishful thinking and complacency. Hamilton lived in a world of moral absolutes and was not especially prone to compromise or consensus building. Where Washington and Jefferson had a gift for voicing the hopes of ordinary people, Hamilton had no special interest in echoing popular preferences. Much too avowedly elitist to become president, he lacked what Woodrow Wilson defined as an essential ingredient for political leadership: profound sympathy with those whom he leads, a sympathy which is insight, an insight which is of the heart rather than of the intellect. Alexander Hamilton enjoyed no such mystic bond with the American people. This may have been why Madison was so adamant that Hamilton never could have got in as president. A baser reason may explain Hamilton's reluctance to stand for the presidency. During the 1796 election, Noah Webster, then a Federalist editor, suggested in his newspaper, The Minerva, that Hamilton might be an appropriate presidential candidate. According to scandalmonger James T. Callender, an unnamed Republican saw this and dispatched an emissary to New York, who confronted Hamilton to inform him that if Webster should in future print a single paragraph on that head, the Mariah Reynolds papers would instantly be laid before the world. It is believed the message was delivered to Mr. Hamilton, for the Minerva became silent. While Hamilton knew he would not succeed Washington, he wasn't about to play a passive role in 1796, the first contested presidential race in American history, and the first dominated by parties. At the time, it was still considered crass for candidates to campaign or violate the charade of passivity, and this magnified the influence of party leaders. Madison began to agitate for Jefferson, who let his friend carry the burden. Similarly, the Federalist frontrunner, John Adams, declared, "I am determined to be a silent spectator of the silly and wicked game." At first, Hamilton told a correspondent that his one overriding goal was to stop Thomas Jefferson from becoming president. "All personal and partial considerations must be discarded, and everything must give way to the great object of excluding Jefferson." He even toyed with backing Patrick Henry, who had grown estranged from Virginia Republicans and might erode support for Jefferson in the South, where Federalists were weak. When Henry refused to run, Hamilton turned to another dark horse Southerner, Thomas Pinckney, a wartime hero and former governor of South Carolina who had served as an American diplomat in Spain and England. Hamilton's support for Pinckney's candidacy set him on a collision course with Adams, who regarded himself as the legitimate successor to the presidency. There was a vague understanding among Federalists that Adams would be the presidential and Pinckney the vice presidential candidate. Hamilton's unspoken preference for Pinckney was not immediately apparent because under the old constitutional rules, electors did not distinguish between their votes for president and vice president. Some Federalists planned to withhold votes from Pinckney to ensure that Adams became president, leaving Hamilton with a haunting fear that Jefferson might accidentally become president or vice president. We recall his similar fear that Washington might be denied the first presidency by accident. As a party chieftain, Hamilton stuck to his official position that Federalist electors should cast their votes equally for Adams and Pinckney. This surface neutrality, however, was really a stratagem to elect Pinckney as president. Since Pinckney was the stronger candidate in the South, if he managed to tie Adams in the North, he would roll up more total votes. Hamilton bet on the wrong horse, a mistake that would haunt the rest of his career. As Treasury Secretary, he had only limited contact with John Adams, who was excluded from the inner policy circle. The two men had maintained a wary distance. Hamilton later said that by the time Washington left office, men of principal influence in the Federal Party began to entertain serious doubts about Adams's fitness for the presidency because of his temperament. Yet Adams's pretensions in several respects were so strong that after mature reflection, they thought it better to indulge their hopes than to listen to their fears. George Washington, who consulted much, pondered much, resolved slowly, resolved surely, was Hamilton's ideal of presidential temperament. John Adams, by contrast, was fiery and dyspeptic, as volatile as Washington was steady. Hamilton contrasted Pinckney's far more discreet and conciliatory personality to the disgusting egotism, the distempered jealousy, and the ungovernable discretion of John Adams. These observations, written later, probably expressed reservations that Hamilton harbored in more muted form at the time. At first, Adams did not suspect Hamilton's duplicity in the campaign. He told friends that Hamilton genuinely feared that his own weakness as a presidential candidate might elect Jefferson, and that Hamilton supported Pinckney as an alternative only in case he himself could not win. When Jefferson wrote to warn Adams that you may be cheated of your succession by a trick worthy of the subtlety of your arch friend of New York, Madison persuaded Jefferson not to send the letter, lest it be interpreted as a crude effort to stir up dissension among Federalists. In late December, however, Elbridge Gerry presented Adams with evidence from Aaron Burr, the self-promoting Republican favorite for vice president, that exposed Hamilton's quiet efforts to elect Pinckney ahead of Adams. Both John and Abigail Adams were shocked. "Beware that spare Cassius," has always occurred to me when I have seen that cock sparrow, Abigail told her husband of Hamilton. "I have ever kept my eye on him." "I shall take no more notice of his puppyhood," John replied, "but return to him the same conduct that I always did, that is, to keep him at a distance." This was Adams's opening volley in an unending stream of abuse against Hamilton, whom he termed as great a hypocrite as any in the U.S. "His intrigues in the election I despise." He thought Hamilton had championed Pinckney as somebody more pliant to his own ambitions, someone who would create an army of horse and foot with Mr. Hamilton at their head. Madison likewise thought that Hamilton feared that someone such as Adams was too headstrong to be a fit puppet for his intrigues behind the screen. Adams's wrath against Hamilton was understandable, but he immediately stooped to personal insults and called Hamilton a Creole bastard. Such scurrilous comments about Hamilton persisted throughout Adams's presidency and inflamed the already tense situation between the two men. On October 15, 1796, John Beckley, the House clerk, alerted James Madison to a string of essays launched under the signature Phocion in the Gazette of the United States. Beckley divined that Hamilton was the author and guessed his dual intent: to denigrate Jefferson as a presidential candidate and tepidly endorse Adams. Between October 14th and November 24th, the voluble Phocion published 25 installments of election commentary. Although John Adams also identified Hamilton as the author, these essays have inexplicably been omitted from Hamilton's collected papers and biographies. They are not only unmistakably Hamiltonian in style, mocking, brilliant, prolix, bombastic, sometimes hair-splitting, but also characteristic in their obsession with Jefferson and the sanguinary turmoil of the French Revolution. Hamilton made little effort to conceal his identity, quoting earlier things he had written almost verbatim, a rare case of Hamilton cannibalizing his own work. For instance, writing as Catullus on September 29, 1792, Hamilton had called Jefferson a Caesar coyly refusing the proffered diadem and said he was tenaciously grasping the substance of imperial domination. Now, Phocion likened Jefferson to a proto-Caesar who had coyly refused the proffered diadem while tenaciously grasping the substance of imperial domination. Once again, Hamilton portrayed Jefferson as a closet voluptuary hiding behind the garb of Republican simplicity. Phocion reviewed Jefferson's career from the time when, as Virginia governor, he had fled from British troops. Hamilton detected similar cowardice in Jefferson's departure from Washington's cabinet at a moment of national danger. How different was the conduct of the spirited and truly patriotic Hamilton? Hamilton asked, almost advertising his presence. He wished to retire as much as the philosopher of Monticello. He had a large family, and his little fortune was fast melting away in the expensive metropolis. but with a Roman spirit he declared that much as he wished for retirement, yet he would remain at his post as long as there was any danger of his country being involved in war. The Phocian essays contain the most withering critique that Hamilton ever leveled at Jefferson as a slaveholder, and they hint heavily at knowledge of the Sally Hemings affair. Visitors to Monticello noted the many light-skinned slaves in residence, especially the Hemings family. One such visitor in 1786, the Comte de Volnay, expressed astonishment in his journal. "But I was amazed to see children as white as I was called blacks and treated as such." In theory, Jefferson could have fathered all of Sally Hemings's children. Fawn M. Brody has written, "Jefferson was not only not distant from Sally Hemings, but in the same house 9 months before the births of each of her 7 children, and she conceived no children when he was not there." Jefferson freed only 2 slaves in his lifetime, and another 5 in his will, and all belonged to the Hemings family, though he excluded Sally. On her deathbed, Sally Hemings told her son Madison that he and his siblings were Jefferson's children. In 1998, DNA tests confirmed that Jefferson, or some male in his family, had likely fathered at least one of Sally Hemings's children, Eston. Reading between the lines of Phocian, one surmises that Hamilton knew all about Sally Hemings, quite possibly from Angelica Church. In the first Phocian essay, Hamilton listed 8 virtues claimed for Jefferson and demolished each in turn. "Was Jefferson a good moral philosopher?" Hamilton replied with sarcasm, "If it can be shown that he has disapproved of the cruelties which have stained the French Revolution, his qualities as a good moral philosopher would be valuable ingredients in the character of the President of the United States." Had Jefferson made discoveries in the useful arts? Hamilton drolly evoked an airy philosopher at Monticello, impaling butterflies and insects and contriving turnabout chairs for the benefit of his fellow citizens and mankind in general. But Hamilton was just warming up for his real indictment of Jefferson as a hypocritical slaveholder. He observed that in Notes on the State of Virginia, written in the early 1780s, Jefferson had argued for emancipating Virginia's slaves and shipping them elsewhere, exported to some less friendly region where they might all be murdered or reduced to a more wretched state of slavery. He ridiculed Jefferson's pseudo-scientific belief that blacks were genetically inferior to whites. In Notes, Jefferson had said of blacks, "They secrete less by the kidneys and more by the glands of the skin, which gives them a very strong and disagreeable odor." Hamilton further quoted him, "The first difference which strikes us is that of color. Whether the black of the Negro resides in the reticular membrane between the skin and the scarf skin, epidermis, or in the scarf skin itself. Whether it proceeds from the color of the blood or the color of the bile, or from that of some other secretion, the difference is fixed in nature and is as real as if the cause were better known to us." Hamilton taunted Jefferson about holding contradictory beliefs on race, saying that he could not make up his mind whether slaves belonged to the human race or not, with the result that he ranked blacks as a peculiar race of animals below man and above the orangutan, a high kind of brute hitherto undescribed. This referred to a passage in Notes in which Jefferson said that blacks favored the beauty of whites over their own kind and cited the preferences of the orangutan for the black woman over those of his own species. Orangutan also denoted the wild man of the woods in the Malay language. Hamilton then touched on the subject that he must have known Jefferson would dread above all others, sexual relations between masters and slaves. At one moment, he, Jefferson, is anxious to emancipate the blacks to vindicate the liberty of the human race. At another, he discovers that the blacks are of a different race from the human race, and therefore, when emancipated, they must be instantly removed beyond the reach of mixture, lest he or she should stain the blood of his or her master, not recollecting what from his situation and other circumstances he ought to have recollected, that this mixture may take place while the Negro remains in slavery. He must have seen all around him sufficient marks of this staining of blood to have been convinced that retaining them in slavery would not prevent it. It is this last suggestion that seems to betoken knowledge of Sally Hemings. Until this point, One can applaud Hamilton for satirizing Jefferson's bigotry and raising taboo issues about his sexual behavior that were otherwise to slumber for two centuries. Unfortunately, the further one digs into the Phocian essays, the more apparent it becomes that Hamilton was engaging in devious manipulation of the Southern vote. He was trying to turn Southern slaveholders against Jefferson by asking whether they wanted a president who promulgates his approbation of a speedy emancipation of their slaves. Hamilton was trying to have it both ways. As an abolitionist, he wanted to expose Jefferson's disingenuous sympathy for the slaves. As a Federalist, he wanted to frighten slaveholders into thinking that Jefferson might act on that sympathy and emancipate their slaves. When Phocian turned to John Adams, the Massachusetts patriot appeared to great advantage compared to Jefferson. Hamilton paid Adams a mighty compliment, describing him as a citizen preeminent for his early, intrepid, faithful, persevering, and comprehensively useful services, a man pure and unspotted in private life, a patriot having a high and solid title to the esteem, the gratitude, and the confidence of his fellow citizens. In September 1792, Hamilton had written as Catullus that Adams was preeminent for his early, intrepid, faithful, persevering, and comprehensively useful services to his country, a man pure and unspotted in private life, a citizen having a high and solid title to the esteem, the gratitude, and the confidence of his fellow citizens. He cited 30 years of unblemished public conduct and said the Jeffersonian press had distorted Adams's political writings, trying to convert him into a monarchist. "For my own part," Hamilton concluded, "were I a Southern planter owning Negroes, I should be 10,000 times more alarmed at Mr. Jefferson's ardent wish for emancipation than at Mr. Adams's system of checks and balances." At first glance, Hamilton's paean to Adams suggests an unqualified endorsement and seems fully consistent with Hamilton's stated position that Federalists should vote equally for Adams and Pinckney. Nonetheless, one wonders whether there was not a subtle strategy here to sabotage Adams. Hamilton knew that if he could prompt Southern slaveholders to desert Jefferson over emancipation, they would not opt for Adams, an abolitionist, but for Thomas Pinckney of South Carolina. There was no way that invoking the slavery issue could assist Adams in the South, where he needed the votes. When the ballots were counted in February 1797, the outcome was a split ticket. Adams became president with 71 electoral votes and Jefferson vice president with 68. Pinckney received 59 votes and Burr, making a miserable showing in the South, only 30. Renegade electors in New England had reversed Hamilton's strategy and denied Pinckney 18 votes. The New England states had voted solidly for Adams, while the South went for Jefferson. Adams had been prepared to resign if he were only reelected as vice president or subjected to the indignity of a tie vote that threw the election into the House of Representatives. He regarded his thin victory as also a blow to his pride, however, and blamed it on followers of Hamilton and Jefferson. As both parties despaired of obtaining their favorite, he later wrote with self-pity, Adams was brought in by a miserable majority of one or two votes, with the deliberate intention to sacrifice him at the next election. His administration was therefore never supported by either party, but vilified and libeled by both. He blamed Hamilton more than Jefferson for this slim margin and spent the next 4 years trying to punish him. Jefferson did not especially mind winning second place. Since resigning as Secretary of State, he had been in isolation at his mountain fastness at Monticello. "From 1793 to 1797, I remained closely at home, saw none but those who came there, and at length became very sensible of the ill effect it had on my own mind. It led to an antisocial and misanthropic state of mind," he told his daughter. With his unerring sense of timing, Jefferson did not think the moment auspicious for a Republican president. Troubles were still brewing with France, and he was happy to let Adams bear the brunt. Sure that the wheel of history would soon turn in his favor, the prescient Jefferson counseled patience to Madison. Many Republicans preferred President Adams to Washington, if only because of his distance from Hamilton. The Jeffersonian Aurora celebrated Adams's anticipated victory with an implicit swipe at Washington and Hamilton. There can be no doubt that Adams would not be a puppet. that having an opinion and judgment of his own, he would act from his own impulses rather than the impulses of others. Similarly, Jefferson welcomed an Adams presidency as perhaps the only sure barrier against Hamilton's getting in. Though currently estranged from Adams, Jefferson had been dear friends with him and Abigail in Paris, and once the election was over, he sought to ingratiate himself with the president-elect and turn him against Hamilton by dwelling on the latter's election machinations. There is reason to believe that Adams is detached from Hamilton, and there is a possibility he may swerve from his politics, he told one confidant. Hamilton studiously monitored the attempted rapprochement between Adams and Jefferson. Mr. Adams is president, Mr. Jefferson vice president, he reported to Rufus King, now the American minister in London. Our Jacobins say they are well pleased and that the lion and the lamb are to lie down together. Hamilton was skeptical about this truce, seeing Jefferson as too wedded to ideology to make compromises. Hamilton received fair warning that Adams intended to retaliate for his disloyalty during the election. That January, Hamilton was laid up with an injured leg that resulted from serving on nocturnal patrols that sought to stop a rash of mysterious fires in New York, fires that may have been related to slave revolts. Stephen Higginson of Boston told Hamilton that the blind or devoted partisans of Mr. Adams were accusing him of leading a cabal that had tried to swing the election for Thomas Pinckney. At the head of this junto, as they call it, they place you and Mr. Jay, and they attribute the design to him and you of excluding Adams from the presidency. Hamilton thus went from unmatched access to President Washington to total exclusion from President Adams. Given his belief in Hamilton's treachery, Adams made the seemingly contradictory decision to retain Washington's cabinet, which was filled with Hamilton's friends, admirers, and former colleagues. Adams was to come to regret that decision as much as any other he made in office. Chapter 29. The Man in the Glass Bubble. It was ironic that John Adams, like Hamilton, was denigrated as a monarchist because he grew up without the patrician comforts enjoyed by Jefferson and Madison, who were the quickest to apply the epithet against him. He was born in Braintree, Massachusetts, to a father who toiled as a farmer in summer and as a shoemaker in winter. Though his family lacked wealth, it boasted a proud ancestry, tracing its roots back to Puritans who had emigrated from England in the 1630s. My father, grandfather, great-grandfather, and great-great-grandfather were all inhabitants of Braintree and all independent country gentlemen. Adams was schooled in the ascetic virtues of Puritan New England. Thrift, hard work, self-criticism, public service, plain talk, and a morbid dread of ostentation. As a young man, he wrote, "A puffy, vain, conceited conversation never fails to bring a man into contempt, although his natural endowments be ever so great and his application and industry ever so intense." Much of his life's drama arose from the intense, often fitful, sometimes tormenting struggle to measure up to his own impossibly high standards, and he never entirely made peace with his own craving for fame and recognition. After a formal education that began at age 6, Adams entered Harvard at 15, the first in his family to attend college. He briefly taught school in Worcester, then turned to law as the most promising career route. In 1764, he married Abigail Smith, a smart, sharp-tongued minister's daughter with a passion for politics and books. Abigail Adams tended the farm and raised the children while John roamed the world on diplomatic missions. Before Hamilton had arrived in North America, Adams had fought against the Stamp Act and defended British soldiers accused of killing 5 colonists in the so-called Boston Massacre of 1770. This legal work displayed a perverse streak of independence in Adams that ranked among his most attractive qualities. He was a born gadfly, always skeptical of reigning orthodoxy. Like Hamilton, he was an ambivalent revolutionary, appalled by the repressive measures of the British crown, but unsettled by the disorder of the rebel colonists. He always had a vivid sense of how easily righteous causes could degenerate into mob excess. Before independence, he asked himself what the multitude, the vulgar, the herd, the rabble, the mob would do if the colonists flouted royal authority. "I feel unutterable anxiety," he confessed to his diary. At the Continental Congress, John Adams emerged as the most impassioned voice for independence, leaping to his feet in rich bursts of oratory. All the while, this feisty, rough-hewn lawyer brooded about potential anarchy. "There is one thing, my dear sir, that must be attempted and most sacredly observed, or we are all undone," he told a friend in 1776. "There must be decency and respect and veneration introduced for persons of authority of every rank." His dedication in Congress was prodigious. He sat on 90 congressional committees, chairing 25 of them. He also laid claim to having been the main talent scout of the Revolution, touting Washington as commander of the Continental Army and recruiting Jefferson to write the Declaration of Independence. Somehow, Adams also found time to draft a constitution for Massachusetts and publish a pamphlet, Thoughts on Government, which influenced other state constitutions. Adams served his country with sustained diplomatic assignments in London, Paris, and Amsterdam. In 1782, he coaxed the Dutch into recognizing the United States and cajoled a $2 million loan from Amsterdam bankers. His Paris stay brought him into close contact with both Franklin and Jefferson. Adams could not match their social graces and was quite out of his element, fretted his friend Jonathan Sewall. "He cannot dance, drink, game, flatter, promise, dress, swear with the gentlemen, and talk small talk or flirt with the ladies." In addition, Franklin's blithe hedonism offended the austere New England soul of John Adams. "His whole life has been one continued insult to good manners and to decency," Adams complained. Franklin's fame in France was a blow to Adams's amour propre, his sense that he was the superior man. Franklin himself captured Adams with a penetrating epigram. "He means well for his country, is always an honest man, often a wise one, but sometimes, and in some things, absolutely out of his senses." Franklin was one of the first to spot the paranoid streak that came to mar Adams's career. In 1783, he grumbled about the ravings of Adams, who suspected him and the Comte de Vergennes, the French foreign minister, of plots against him, which have no existence but in his own troubled imaginations. In a similar vein, Bernard Balin later observed of Adams, "Sensitive to insults, imaginary and real, he felt the world was generally hostile to himself and to the American cause, which was the greatest passion of his life. There were enemies on all sides." The prickly Adams developed a tender affection for Jefferson, albeit one mingled with an uneasy sense of his unfathomable mystery. No less than Hamilton, Adams perceived that Jefferson, behind the facade of philosophic tranquility, was eaten to a honeycomb with ambition. Jefferson, in turn, detected traces of the curmudgeon in Adams. "He hates Franklin, he hates Jay, he hates the French, he hates the English," he told Madison from Paris. "To whom will he adhere? His vanity is a lineament in his character which had entirely escaped me." 4 years later, Jefferson sent Madison a more potent version of this same critique, calling Adams "vain, irritable, and a bad calculator of the force and probable effect of the motives which govern men." For all that, Jefferson appreciated Adams as a warm-hearted, convivial spirit, a fascinating conversationalist, and a man of bedrock integrity. Their relationship had foundered in 1791 when Jefferson lauded the Rights of Man by Thomas Paine by drawing an invidious contrast to the political heresies which have sprung up among us. A cutting reference to Adams's Discourses on Davila, which Jeffersonians read as a plea for a hereditary presidency. After Jefferson stepped down as Secretary of State, he and Adams seldom corresponded during the next 3 years. John Adams was an unprepossessing man. Short and paunchy, with a round, jowly face and a pale complexion, he had piercing eyes that protruded from behind thick lids. He had an exceedingly active mind, always bubbling with words. Images welled up spontaneously from his imagination, as in his extraordinary description of Thomas Paine as the satyr of the age, a mongrel between pig and puppy, begotten by a wild boar on a butch wolf. Because he bared his psyche in diaries and letters, we know him more intimately than any other founder. One can summon up an army of adjectives for John Adams: crotchety, opinionated, endearing, temperamental, frank, erudite, outspoken, generous, eccentric, restless, petty, choleric, philosophical, plucky, quirky, pugnacious, fanciful, stubborn, and whimsical, and scarcely exhaust the possibilities. His life was a kaleidoscope of constantly shifting moods. Charles Francis Adams summed up his mercurial grandfather well when he wrote that he could be very warm and engaging in ordinary conversation, but extremely violent when provoked. Adams was a mass of psychosomatic symptoms, his nervous tics and tremors often betraying extreme inner tension. "My constitution is a glass bubble," he once said, and he had a medical history of headaches, fatigue, chest pains, failing eyesight, and insomnia to prove it. In 1776, he etched this self-portrait. "My face is grown pale, my eyes weak and inflamed, my nerves tremulous." He seems to have undergone some form of nervous breakdown during his time in Amsterdam, suffering from periods of withdrawal from society and flashes of temper. Later on, he complained of quivering fingers and lost several teeth from pyorrhea, forcing him to speak with a lisp. By the time he became president, the 61-year-old John Adams looked like a pudgy, toothless old man. But it was Adams's vanity, not premature aging, that most detracted from his image. "Vanity, I am sensible, is my cardinal vice and cardinal folly," he admitted as a young man. At least 30 times he posed for portraits and quibbled with the results. From some underlying insecurity, he spent inordinate time brooding about his place in history. He worried that rivals would overshadow him or steal credit that he deserved. This vanity made him feel unappreciated. In 1812, he told Benjamin Rush, "From the year 1761, now more than 50 years, I have constantly lived in an enemy's country." Biographer Joseph Ellis has observed of Adams, "Lurking in his heart was a frantic and uncontrollable craving for personal vindication, a lust for fame that was so obsessive and so poisoned by his accurate awareness that history would not do him justice, that he often appeared less like a worthy member of the American Gallery of Greats than a beleaguered and pathetic madman." This insecurity fostered envy of other founders. He even bemoaned the impious idolatry of Washington, dubbing him Old Muttonhead, and seemed bothered by all the adulation he received. He thought Washington better at striking heroic poses than providing leadership. In later writings, he faulted Washington's intelligence, said he could not write a sentence without misspelling some word, and took him to task for being but very superficially read in the history of any age, nation, or country. Relatedly, by the time he became president, Adams found Alexander Hamilton flamboyant, lascivious, and egotistical, a conceited, conniving upstart who had been unfairly catapulted above him in Washington's government. In considering Adams's presidency, two or three traits should be emphasized because they form the burden of Hamilton's critique of him. Adams could be thin-skinned and hypersensitive, as he himself acknowledged. "My temper in general has been tranquil, except when any instance of extraordinary madness, deceit, hypocrisy, ingratitude, treachery, or perfidy has suddenly struck me," Adams once confided. "Then I have always been irascible enough." He did not handle pressure very well. He tended to store up anger until his patience had been tested long enough. Then he would explode. He told Benjamin Rush, "There had been very many times in my life when I have been so agitated in my own mind as to have no consideration at all of the light in which my words, actions, and even writings would be considered by others." His combative spirit did not always lend itself to presidential decorum, social lies, or useful flattery. In old age, he said that as a public figure, "I refused to suffer in silence. I sighed, sobbed, and groaned, and sometimes screeched and screamed, and I must confess to my shame and sorrow that I sometimes swore." Had they been more alike in style and temperament, Hamilton and Adams might have embraced as political comrades, since their views tallied on so many issues. Consider this statement from Adams: "Popularity was never my mistress, nor was I ever or shall I ever be a popular man. But one thing I know. A man must be sensible of the errors of the people and upon his guard against them, and must run the risk of their displeasure sometimes, or he will never do them any good in the long run." This was Hamilton's credo as well. Like Hamilton, Adams had sufficient faith in the people to want liberty for them, but enough doubts to want to constrain their representatives with an ironclad system of checks and balances. Both men were staunch nationalists, admired the British system, were averse to utopian thinking, rejected romantic notions that human nature could be purified by democracy, and thought the masses could be no less tyrannical than kings. Both also feared the French Revolution as a possible portent for America. For Adams, events in France reeked of blood and horror, of murder and massacre, of ambition and avarice. On the other hand, Adams lacked Hamilton's financial acumen. He favored a nation of small farmers and expressed grave reservations about aspects of Hamilton's economic program, thinking that it was informed by the mercenary spirit of commerce. He detested banks and believed that Hamilton's system would swindle the poor and release the gangrene of avarice into the American atmosphere. Most importantly for his presidency, John Adams did not care for standing armies or closer relations with Great Britain, both views that were to lead to severe clashes with Hamilton. Whatever the congruence of their political views, Hamilton and Adams had contrasting personalities. Smoothly artful in society, Hamilton could have been a European courtier. He was much more worldly than Adams. As a young man, notes biographer David McCullough, Adams often felt ill at ease, hopelessly awkward. He sensed people were laughing at him, as sometimes they were, and this was especially hurtful. Where the young Adams dreaded the mockery of others, the young Hamilton was uplifted by an encouraging sense of destiny. It is easy to see why Adams resented Hamilton as a preening, uppity young man. He had missed the formative struggles of the American Revolution dating back to the 1760s. Fisher Ames noted that Adams tended to hold cheap any reputation that wasn't founded and topped off during the Revolution. By this standard, Hamilton was an intruder, a bumptious latecomer to the restricted honor roll of American founders. Adams ended up regarding Hamilton as someone in a delirium of ambition. He had been blown up with vanity by the Tories, had fixed his eye on the highest station in America, and he hated every man, young or old, who stood in his way. For all his fundamental decency, patriotism, and good heart, John Adams struck the lowest blows against Alexander Hamilton. He was preoccupied with Hamilton's illegitimacy and foreign birth, and could be quite heartless on the subject. He characterized Hamilton as being born on a speck more obscure than Corsica, from an original not only contemptible but infamous, with infinitely less courage and capacity than Bonaparte. On one occasion, borrowing a line from Jonathan Swift, he vilified Hamilton as the bastard brat of a Scotch peddler. At other times, Hamilton became the Scottish Creolian of Nevis, or the Creole bastard. As a foreigner, Adams alleged, Hamilton was devoid of knowledge of the American character or true appreciation of the Revolution's patriots, and could scarcely acquire the opinions, feelings, or principles of the American people. Adams found nothing admirable in the extraordinary saga of this self-made man from the tropics. Hamilton had great disadvantages, he told Benjamin Rush. His original was infamous, his place of birth and education were foreign countries, his fortune was poverty itself. Adams made these misfortunes sound like so many personal failings. A disproportionate number of references to Hamilton's womanizing come from the straight-laced Adams. Hamilton I know to be a proud, spirited, conceited, aspiring mortal, always pretending to morality, said Adams, but with as debauched morals as old Franklin, who was more his model than anyone I know. Hamilton, he said, had a superabundance of secretions which he could not find whores enough to draw off. His fornications, adulteries, and his incests, an apparent insinuation that he had slept with Angelica Church, were propagated far and wide. In time, Adams came to detest Hamilton so much that he fell victim to sheer credulity. Surely Adams was the only person ever to accuse Hamilton of slacking off at Treasury or of lazily fobbing off work onto subordinates so that he could frolic in Philadelphia society. In one particularly bizarre letter, Adams intimated that Hamilton might have owed his eloquence to drug usage. In his last years, he informed a friend with a straight face, I have been told by Parson Montague of Dedham, though I will not vouch for the truth of it, that General Hamilton never wrote or spoke at the bar or elsewhere in public without a bit of opium in his mouth. Despite these absurd aspersions against Hamilton, Adams continued to see himself as a man who always turned the other cheek. "I never wrote a line of slander against my bitterest enemy," he told Mercy Warren, "nor encouraged it in any other." Adams had spent most of his vice presidency exiled in the Senate, casting a record 31 tie-breaking votes. Of the number two post, he said wearily but indelibly that it was the most insignificant office that ever the invention of man contrived or his imagination conceived. Washington seldom consulted him, banishing him to the distant wings of power. When John Adams was sworn in as the second president on March 4, 1797, he had on a gray suit and had powdered his hair and brandished a ceremonial sword at his side. Washington exuded the serenity of a successful outgoing president, while Adams seemed more unsure of himself and told Abigail later that he had been afraid he would faint. Upon leaving Congress Hall, Washington, Adams, and Jefferson executed a delicate little minuet of etiquette, with Washington magnanimously insisting that Adams and Jefferson precede him. Shy in many ways, Adams disliked the trappings of power. "I hate speeches, messages, addresses, and answers, proclamations, and such affected, studied, contraband things," he told Abigail. "I hate levees and drawing rooms. I hate to speak to 1,000 people to whom I have nothing to say." Beyond the unenviable task of succeeding Washington, Adams had several handicaps to overcome. Despite long years in politics, he had never exercised executive power at the state or federal level, and he detested political parties at a time when America was being torn asunder by factions. As president, Adams was the nominal head of the Federalists, yet he dreamed of being a nonpartisan president. Hence, he effectively abdicated the role of partisan leader, which Hamilton, with his taste for power, was only too glad to assume. In later years, Adams conceded that in holding himself apart from Hamilton, the sovereign pontiff of federalism, he knew he would cause all of Hamilton's cardinals to excite the whole church to excommunicate and anathematize me. During his presidency, Adams was often stranded between the Federalists and the Republicans, and accepted by neither. It was to prove a rare case in American history of the president hesitating to function as the de facto party leader. This first transfer of presidential power naturally awakened fears of civil war, despotism, and foreign intrigue. To soothe worries about an orderly succession and placate the Federalists, Adams took the very statesmanlike step of retaining the core of Washington's cabinet. Timothy Pickering at State, Oliver Wolcott Jr. at Treasury, and James McHenry at War, the triumvirate that he came to loathe as traitors. All three men were identified with Hamilton and the rabidly Anglophile wing of the party known as High Federalists. Why did Adams submit to a situation that seems, in retrospect, fraught with trouble? "Washington had appointed them, and I knew it would turn the world upside down if I removed any one of them," he explained. "I had then no particular objection to any of them." As he developed objections to his cabinet members, he portrayed himself as their helpless captive, duped by Hamilton and his minions. Hamilton did not think Adams could sidestep responsibility so lightly. "As the president nominates his ministers and may displace them when he pleases, it must be his own fault if he be not surrounded by men who for ability and integrity deserve his confidence." John Adams told two stories of his presidency that never quite jibed. In one, he claimed to be an innocent bystander, long oblivious of Hamilton's influence over his cabinet members. He had no idea until the end, he said, that they were receiving guidance from his foe. When he belatedly discovered the plot, he moved swiftly to purge the culprits. In another version, Adams claimed that he had known all along that Hamilton controlled the cabinet because he had already controlled it under Washington. The truth is, Hamilton's influence over Washington was so well known that no man fit for the office of state or war would accept either. For this reason, Washington was driven to the necessity of appointing such as would accept. And this necessity was, in my opinion, the real cause of his retirement from office. For you may depend upon it, that retirement was not voluntary. According to Adams, Washington was merely the titular president, a viceroy under Hamilton. Furthermore, wrote Adams, I could not name a man who was not devoted to Hamilton without kindling a fire. I soon found that if I had not the previous consent of the heads of departments and the approbation of Mr. Hamilton, I ran the utmost risk of a dead negative, veto, in the Senate. After Adams was inaugurated, Hamilton inadvertently ruffled the new president by sending him an unsolicited memorandum suggesting policies for the new administration. This long, elaborate letter, Adams said, contained a whole system of instruction for the conduct of the president, the Senate, and the House of Representatives. I read it very deliberately and really thought the man was in a delirium. I despised and detested the letter too much to take a copy of it. The sort of advice that Washington had so valued, Adams chose to resent. Not surprisingly, Hamilton wanted to maintain the intellectual preeminence he had enjoyed under Washington. Once again, he tried to be the one-man brain trust, promiscuously dispensing his opinions, and he was probably essaying what access he would enjoy under Adams. Hamilton was not the sort to surrender his proximity to power. Having mastered many arcane issues, he aspired to be the shadow president of the Federalists. In his endless missives to Pickering, Wolcott, and McHenry, one can feel Hamilton's frustration that he no longer held his hands on the levers of power. Washington had always shown great care and humility in soliciting the views of his cabinet. Adams, in contrast, often disregarded his cabinet and enlisted friends and family, especially Abigail, as trusted advisors. His cabinet members found him aloof and capricious, and prone to bark out orders instead of asking opinions. Oliver Wolcott, Jr., who had one of the warmer relationships with Adams, gave this sarcastic description of the administration. Thus are the United States governed, as Jupiter is represented to have governed Olympus. Without regarding the opinions of friends or enemies, all are summoned to hear, reverence, and obey the unchangeable fiat. The friction between Adams and his cabinet was exacerbated by the president's puzzling retreats to his home in Quincy, Massachusetts. As a member of the Continental Congress and a diplomat in Europe, Adams had been ideally diligent and self-sacrificing, enduring separations from Abigail of as long as 5 years. Especially during John's later years as vice president, Abigail often suffered from rheumatism and was forced to stay in Massachusetts. Adams became an absentee official, spending as many as 9 months per year away from Philadelphia. During one foreign policy crisis, Washington complained to his cabinet about his truant vice president. Presuming that the vice president will have left the seat of government for Boston, I have not requested his opinion to be taken. Should it be otherwise, I wish him to be consulted. As president, Adams stuck to a similarly peculiar schedule and frequently seemed to be absent from his own administration. During his first year in office, he spent 4 months in Quincy, twice as long a period as Washington had ever left the capital. At times, Adams seemed to be in headlong flight from his own government, spending up to 7 months at a stretch in Massachusetts and trying to run the government by dispatch. Washington, mystified by this behavior, groaned that it gives much discontent to the friends of government, while its enemies chuckle at it and think it a favorable omen for them. Adams, of course, blamed Hamilton for his loss of control over his cabinet and said bitterly that I was, as president, a mere cipher. But it is hard to separate Adams's absences from the disloyalty of his cabinet. Biographer David McCullough has observed, Adams's presence at the center of things was what the country rightfully expected and could indeed have made a difference. It was an inauspicious situation for the Federalists. The Republican leaders, Jefferson and Madison, the latter having now retired from Congress to Montpelier, his Virginia plantation, exhibited remarkable discipline and discretion. The two Virginians were shrewd men with an imperviously close bond and an impressive degree of patience and self-control. Meanwhile, the Federalists, united for 2 terms under Washington, were about to degenerate into a fractured party, led by 2 brilliant and unstoppable windbags, Adams and Hamilton, who cordially detested each other. Both were hasty, erratic, impulsive men, and capable of atrocious judgment. And both had blazing gifts for invective, which they eventually turned against each other. Chapter 30. Flying Too Near the Sun. That spring, Hamilton received a long overdue letter from Scotland, several decades overdue, in fact, that afforded him profound satisfaction. It came from William Hamilton, one of his father's younger brothers, who amiably related news of his Scottish relatives. This marked the first time that Hamilton, 42, had any contact with his paternal family. Despite a lack of direct dealings with them, he had valued his Scottish ancestry, serving as an officer of the St. Andrews Society of New York State. In a cordial reply, Hamilton included the only thumbnail sketch of his life that he ever set down. It provided the contours of his life without shading. As so often in personal matters with Hamilton, the letter was essentially evasive. He assumed that his uncle knew about his father's early mishaps in the West Indies and the separation it had caused in the family. But Hamilton's letter confirms that James Hamilton had subsequently lost touch with his family, since Alexander had to inform his uncle that James still languished on St. Vincent. "I have strongly pressed the old gentleman to come to reside with me, which would afford him every enjoyment of which his advanced age is capable. But he has declined it on the ground that the advice of his physicians leads him to fear that the change of climate would be fatal to him." Hamilton gave the impression of being a worldly man, secure in his station, who could afford to downplay his own exploits. He struck a mellow note of personal contentment. "It is impossible to be happier than I am in a wife, and I have 5 children, 4 sons and a daughter, the eldest a son somewhat past 15, who all promise well as far as their years permit and yield me much satisfaction." He told of the pecuniary sacrifice that went with public office and the baneful spirit of faction that had weakened executive authority. The union of these motives with the reflections of prudence in relation to a growing family determined me, as soon as my plan had attained a certain maturity, to withdraw from office. Hamilton seemed eager to stay in touch with his reclaimed relatives. This eagerness has a certain pathos, for Hamilton did not fathom the self-interested nature of the sudden overture from Uncle William. The Scottish Hamiltons had never tried to rescue Alexander from an impoverished, orphan state, and had never congratulated him on his amazing ascent in the world. The only reason William now wrote to Hamilton was for selfish purposes. He had been a successful tobacco and sugar merchant, but his business had gone awry and he needed help. Pretty soon, Hamilton had the odd sensation of receiving a reverential letter from his first cousin, Alexander Hamilton, a Sanskrit scholar who had returned from India because of his father's business troubles. The following year, the Scottish Alexander Hamilton disclosed the true reason behind the correspondence. The family had to find work for his brother, a sailor named Robert, who was prepared to become a naturalized American citizen if he could obtain an assignment with the U.S. Navy. The willingness of the Scottish Hamiltons to exploit their American cousin's eminence seems shameless. Nevertheless, having lacked a family and suffered the taint of illegitimacy, Hamilton took Robert Hamilton into his home for 5 months, squired his young relative around New York, and landed him an appointment as a lieutenant in the U.S. Navy. The grateful Scottish kinsmen hung a portrait of Hamilton above their mantle. Sweet vindication for a man who had started out as a castaway of the islands. But they never made an effort to aid Hamilton's father on St. Vincent or showed the least curiosity about him. Hamilton continued to do favors for his Scottish relatives, who had never done any favors for him. Even more satisfying than this new rapport with his Scottish clan was the return of John and Angelica Church to New York. For years, Angelica had yearned to return home and was held back only by her husband's parliamentary career. "You and my dear Hamilton will never cross the Atlantic," she lamented to Eliza. "I shall never leave this island, and as to meeting in heaven, there will be no pleasure in that." After Hamilton resigned from the Treasury and set up house with Eliza in New York at 26 Broadway, he implored his sister-in-law to come home. "You know how much we all love you," he wrote with accustomed gallantry. "'Tis impossible you can be so well loved where you are. And what is there can be put in competition with the sweet affections of the heart." Hamilton was preaching to the converted. Angelica wanted to rejoin the Hamiltons, reassuring Eliza that, "I hope to pass with you the remainder of my days, that is, if you will be so obliging as to permit my brother, Hamilton, to give me his society, for you know how much I love and admire him." We will see each other every day. Eliza advised Angelica on the fashions that she would find de rigueur in New York. Remember that your waist must be short, your petticoats long, your headdress moderately high, and altogether à la grecque. The church's move to New York was slower than anticipated. In late 1795, they drafted Hamilton to scout luxurious mansions. Harried by 1,000 duties, Hamilton found time to reconnoiter local real estate and bought his in-laws several lots on Broadway. "I am sensible how much trouble I give you," Angelica wrote, "but you will have the goodness to excuse it when you know that it proceeded from a persuasion that I was asking from one who promised me his love and attention if I returned to America." Angelica still wrote to Hamilton in a coquettish style, anointing him the arbiter of wit and elegance, and he gladly reciprocated. "How do you manage to charm all that see you?" he asked her. "While naughty tales are told to you of us, we hear nothing but of your kindness, amiableness, agreeableness, etc." For all his intimacy with Angelica, Hamilton was a bond that still seemed to unite the sisters instead of divide them. As he awaited Angelica's appearance in New York, Hamilton told her that the only rivalry he and Eliza had is in our attachment to you, and we each contend for preeminence in this particular. To whom will you give the apple? This intriguing image alludes to the Trojan prince Paris, who had to hand an apple to the fairest of three goddesses. Eliza would never have harbored deep affection for her sister or allowed Hamilton to write to her so freely if she had been aware of any real transgressions. In one revealing letter, Hamilton said that Eliza consents to everything, except that I should love you as well as herself, and this you are too reasonable to expect. Angelica was always careful to incorporate them both into a triangle of family love. "Embrace my dear Hamilton with all my heart," she wrote to Eliza during the summer of 1796. "Give me leave to love you both affectionately in spite of my being sometimes a little saucy." After years of frustrating delays, the churches at last moved to New York in May 1797. John Barker Church soon established himself as a personage of staggering wealth and New York's foremost insurance underwriter. "His equipage and style of living are several degrees beyond those of any other man amongst us," Robert Troup marveled. Angelica began to throw extravagant parties at which guests dined on plates of polished silver. She usually glittered with diamonds and captivated many socialites. There was something racy about the churches that seemed more reminiscent of London society than New York. Angelica scandalized local matrons by introducing risque European fashions, while John was a compulsive gambler who often played cards into the wee hours. The church's parties featured whist, loo, and games of chance. A guest at these soirees, Hamilton probably drew the attention of gossips who saw him mooning around Angelica's adoring gaze. This was not the only whiff of scandal that followed Hamilton during that summer of 1797. For 4.5 years, the Maria Reynolds affair had remained a well-kept secret, confined to Republican rumor mills and what Hamilton called dark whispers. By a curious coincidence, the churches returned to New York just as that scandal was about to burst into print, so any gossip about Hamilton and Angelica would only have heaped fuel on the flames. In late June, Hamilton saw a newspaper advertisement for a series of pamphlets, subsequently published in book form, with the innocuous title, "The History of the United States for 1796. The notice promised that the series would publish documents pertaining to Hamilton's conduct as Treasury Secretary. Hamilton soon laid his hands on pamphlet number 5, which rehashed old charges of official misconduct and cited documents from James Reynolds and Jacob Clingman. On July 8th, Hamilton published a letter in the Gazette of the United States and admitted the authenticity of the papers, but pointed out that their charges were false and misleading. They were the contrivance of two of the most profligate men in the world to obtain their liberation from imprisonment for a serious crime by the favor of party spirit. No copies of these pamphlets have survived, but number 5 or 6 brought the additional charge of adultery against Hamilton. The author of this malice was the Scottish-born James Thompson Callender, an ugly, misshapen little man who made a career of spewing venom. He was a hack writer who had fled from Edinburgh a few years earlier after being charged with sedition by the British government. having denounced Parliament as a phalanx of mercenaries and the English constitution as a conspiracy of the rich against the poor, he was fated to whirl into Republican circles in America and write for Benjamin Franklin Bache's Aurora. In later years, Jefferson condemned Callender as a poor creature, hypochondriac, drunken, penniless, and unprincipled. But at this time, when Callender flung his darts at the Federalists, Jefferson glorified him as a man of genius and a man of science fled from persecution. In late June 1797, Jefferson was so pleased with Callender's handiwork that he stopped by his lodgings to congratulate him and to buy copies of his scandalous history. In the bound volume, Callender sneaked up on the Reynolds scandal, first reviewing other events of 1796 before pouncing on Hamilton. We now come to a part of the work more delicate, perhaps, than any other. Callender said that he was incensed by the way that Federalists, and Hamilton in particular, the prime mover of the Federal Party, had treated James Monroe, who had just returned to Philadelphia after being recalled as American minister to France. Hamilton, among others, had pleaded with Washington to recall Monroe for his unabashed favoritism toward the French Revolution. Back home, Monroe had huddled with Jefferson, Burr, and Albert Gallatin and expressed indignation over his dismissal. The unfounded reproaches heaped on Mr. Monroe form the immediate motive to the publication of these papers, Callender declared. Indeed, Monroe's connivance in Callender's project was clear to Alexander and Eliza Hamilton, who became unalterably convinced that Monroe had reneged on his confidentiality vow and leaked the Reynolds documents. Callender promised readers that he would debunk Hamilton's pretensions to superior virtue, stating that we shall presently see this great master of morality, although himself the father of a family, confessing that he had an illicit correspondence with another man's wife. For posterity, the Callender disclosures were associated with Hamilton's exposure as a libertine. For Callender, however, this was merely a collateral benefit. His real aim was to resurrect the shop-worn myth, discredited by the Giles investigations, that Hamilton had secretly enriched himself as Treasury Secretary through improper speculation in government securities. In fact, Callender blithely repeated the very error that had initially misled Muhlenberg, Venable, and Monroe in December 1792, that the money Hamilton had paid to James Reynolds related to official misconduct, not to infidelity. Callender's diatribe had a specious air of deep research. He published the entire trove of papers that Hamilton had entrusted to Muhlenberg, Venable, and Monroe. So much correspondence could not refer exclusively to wenching, stated Callender. No man of common sense would believe that it did. Reynolds and his wife affirmed that it respected certain speculations. Callender scorned the very idea of a romantic liaison. Even admitting that Maria Reynolds was the favorite of Mr. Hamilton, for which there appears no evidence but the word of the secretary, this conduct would have been eminently foolish. Mr. Hamilton had only to say that he was sick of his amour, and the influence and hopes of Reynolds at once vanished. Callender denied the authenticity of Maria Reynolds's billets doux to Hamilton, and conjectured that Hamilton had forged them, filling them with spelling errors to make them seem plausible. Quite understandably, Callender could not conceive that someone as smart and calculating as Hamilton could have stayed so long in thrall to an enslaving passion. Hamilton could not have been stupid enough to pay hush money for sex, Callender alleged, so the money paid to James Reynolds had to involve illicit speculation. In fairness to Callender, it is baffling that Hamilton submitted to blackmail for so long. The mystery of why Callender and his cronies disclosed the Reynolds scandal that summer is a tantalizing one. Callender mentioned the recall of James Monroe, but there were other reasons as well. The infamous expose might never have been published if Washington had still been in office. For Republican pamphleteers, it was now open season on the Federalists. Callender wanted to prevent Hamilton from exercising the same influence over Adams that he had over Washington. He also wanted to besmirch Washington's reputation by demonstrating that he had been a puppet mouthing words scripted by Hamilton. Callender contended that Hamilton had received private parcels from Washington with speeches for rewriting. After opening such a parcel, said Mr. Hamilton, what do you think were the contents? Dear Hamilton, put this into style for me. Then, Hamilton supposedly commented, Some speech or letter has been enclosed, which I wrote over again, sent it back, and then the old damned fool gave it away as his own. Evidently, Callender was aware of scuttlebutt that Hamilton had ghostwritten most of Washington's farewell address. Another compelling explanation for the timing of Callender's exposé relates to Hamilton's Phocion essays the previous fall, which had delved openly for the first time into Jefferson's private life. End of Disc 21.